Moon would be enough to shatter the Strat's hopes, and without a strong Japan, the Hive will go back to being brawled over by Shanghai and Beijing. Not just at the next board selection, but for a generation. You think one of the Chinese blocs planned this? To scare the world with what the device we made can do. It was a possibility, now that I mulled it over. The thief must have folded the stolen paper around the device on purpose, to let us know they had it. In my selfish panic, I had assumed they only meant to target me, not the greater forces that had created the Gaiji's device. That's what I call it in my mind, after the invisibility ring from Plato's fable, which tempts even the most virtuous to crime. "Bury this, Mycroft," Ando ordered. "You have Martin's ear, and the Commissioner General's. Bury this before it plunges the Hive back into Chinese monopoly for another 50 years. "I'll do my best, Chief Director. And keep Tycoon away from the members of the Sania Weeksbooth Bash." You may not recognize this Mitsubishi nickname, reader, but Ando means the head of Martin's team, J.E.D.D. Mason. Since there are too many reasons for Ando's nervousness to list here, I will say simply that J.E.D.D. Mason is trusted of Ando, trusted like a son, but still a bit too close to Martin's emperor. "I'll do my best, Chief Director. But you know I only serve. I have no power to decide." Danae broke in. "We know you'll always do your best for us, good Mycroft." I can't express quite how, since there was no threat in her words, but something in her tone, her smile, spoke of my parole. How now she could shatter it at any instant with just 3 words to the Commissioner General. "Only the packaging." I shuddered, and the Chief Director seemed contented by my fear. "Then you may go begin." "Thank you, Chief Director." I scrambled up and bowed, but felt my failure as the couple turned away, the new leash around my neck called blackmail. I could not leave myself or those who depended on me so deeply in their power. There was no resort but French. "Do you know who else came to the Bash House today, Princesse? Apart from Martin?" Both turned, and the Princess relaxed at the music of her birth Bash tongue, returning slow French syllables which flowed from her lips like kisses. "There was someone else?" I could not guess whether her ignorance was feigned or real. "There was a certain sensei." I scanned the back room to confirm that Michi Mitsubishi, the one adopted child interning with Europe and likely to know French, was absent. It was safe to press on. A foster child. Dark blonde, blue eyes. I searched Danae's face, but the illusion of eternal youth, which masks the matron's decades, masks fear lines also. "A gag gene," I added. 28 years old. A statue of cream-white marble seemed to stand before me in that instant, so rigid she became. I felt my hands twitch with the impulse to catch her should she faint. "What a marvelous world," she whispered it, less to me than to the world itself, and her lashes fluttered, fighting back a tear. "You did not know? I have to ask, Princesse. I'm sorry." Danae stepped toward me, away from her husband, who frowned but backed away, respectful of his bride's right to her separate tongue and separate sphere. "I have never known him." She brought her alabaster hands up to her breast, as if cradling an infant, real again in her fingers' memory. I glanced back to the inner chamber, where her many adopted children sprawled and stared, all so different. Hiroaki Mitsubishi, with Thai features. June, European, pale and freckled. Ron, with Middle Eastern tints like Martin, but none like their mother. No one had been surprised when Ando, proud of his pure Japanese breeding, and Danae, just as proudly French, had adopted instead of mixing their blood. But still, to have held a child of her body for a day and never again, even imagining it made me ache. "You must at least have asked where he was taken to be raised," I asked. "What hive he joined?" Another tear-gilded blink. "No, nothing. It was judged kindest that way." "Who took the child away? His Grace, your brother? Your honored husband?" I avoided the French for chief director, since even Ando could recognize that. "It was handed to the doctor." The ghost of a smile softened her sadness. "He didn't cry, brave little one." I told him nothing. "I'm sure he doesn't know. It was the best comfort I could offer." "Thank you." Her thanks warmed me, made me bold. I found it hard to believe that he, of all sensei's in the world, would be sent to that Bosch by chance. "Can you think of anyone who might have traced him? Any reason anyone could have to dredge this up after so long? To embroil him in this mess with the theft and the device?" 3 times she parted her lips. A different syllable shaped each time. But only the 3rd time did she voice it. "Is he happy?" I lowered my eyes. It was the right question. The only real question a loving heart would ask. And had she had a different upbringing, it might have been hard to answer. The patriarch wrote that the half-wit is always happier than the philosopher. But the philosopher would not trade knowledge for ignorance, not for all the happiness in the world. Your son seemed to me half a philosopher, but still half happy. Do you know the reference, reader? Or does your age, forgetful of its past, no longer know Le Patriarche by that worthy epithet? Have you forgotten the first pen stronger than swords? The firebrand who spread reason's light across the earth, battled intolerance, religious persecution, torture, forced kings to bow before the rights of man, and introduced wit into philosophy again? Is Aristotle not still known by the honorable title of the philosopher? Shakespeare, the bard, Brill, the cognitivist? How then can you forget the patriarch? Perhaps you protest, "Thou accusest me unjustly, Mycroft. History has not swallowed this great man, rather he has swallowed history. I do not know who created the first government or built the first wheel. It is so ubiquitous that I do not need to. Just so, my better era does not teach me who first fought for these good heresies you list, for they are now truths, and the blind age that doubted them is well forgotten." Perhaps you are right, reader. It is honor, not dishonor, if you forget the patriarch. We now doubt Aristotle, understand Shakespeare only with footnotes, poke holes in Brill. But the patriarch, whom all earth follows without thinking there could be another way, he has indeed swallowed us up. But he has not so swallowed Danae, reared as she was, as if in his own age, when he, her patriarch, needed defending. Voltaire, reader, the patriarch of the 18th century, the era which has just remade your own. It was Voltaire. A lady of Danae's education knows the corpus of the patriarch by heart. "A good answer, Mycroft." Heartache's remnants gave her French a somber tint. "Thank you. If he has been drawn into this by some cruel manipulator, I know you will protect him." I had meant to trade blackmail for blackmail here, but instead found myself drawn into pity for Danae, and for young Carlyle, too. My mind buzzed with measures to protect them, the lady from the enemies of Mitsubishi and Japan, the senseier from the stern major, from overcautious Thisbe, from himself. Mistakes he might make in the first giddy hours after meeting Bridger. That thought warmed me, the strange, sideways kindness of Providence, which had stripped the gag gene of Bosch and past and family, only to give him a treasure which was, to any sensei, 1,000 times more precious, a miracle. Actually, Princess, I think he has both much knowledge and much happiness, at least where it matters. If some brave painter captured her smile on canvas, it would draw crowds down the centuries. Thank you. Then again, in Japanese, for all to hear, thank you, Mycroft. And we must thank my dear brother for calling you and Martin in to solve this. I know all feel safer in your hands. Director Ando nodded my dismissal, and Princess Danae passed me my servicer's reward at last, a round lunchbox, tied and too heavy to be anything but sushi. My many masters don't always remember they must feed me, that their toil-earned handouts are the only sustenance permitted to we, the unfree. But Danae, this monster from a more barbaric time, always remembers the protocols of servitude. Chapter the Fifth. Aristotle's House. I muse sometimes about where else in history I might have picked to be a slave, if I had had my choice. I could have been a slave in Aristotle's house when he reared Alexander. I could have midwived at the birth of Caesar. As a slave convict, I might have added my sweat-drenched kilometer to the railroads that saddled the great continents, my heaven-bound cable to the first space elevator, or sweated in the rigging of the Santa Maria as she erased the dragons at the world's end and knit the whole sphere closed. If we count apprenticeship as an unfreedom, I might have been the typesetter who forged Newton's Principia, letter by letter with his own black fingers, or the clerk who brought the coffee to Brill's circle as the master ranted into the wee hours with silent Cullen in the corner, already dreaming of her boshes. In any of these servitudes, I would probably have cursed the great works I touched, the great men I called masters, nor would knowing they were great have lessened my suffering one toil-smeared jot. Yet somehow the idea warms me that out of every 1,000 lives of suffering my ancient counterparts endured, one slave was building something that his soul, if it could view all from outside of time, might call great. It cannot balance the pain, but it does console me just a little, and for me, a little is enough. I was scrubbing spilled perfume from Thisbe's bedroom floor when Carlyle Foster made his timid way back to the Sinir Weeksbooth Bosch house. I watched him through the security system, which, for Bridger's safety, Thisbe let me access. He started toward the little stair to Thisbe's door again, but the main door opened for him, beckoning him across the walkway to the front hall, dark and empty. I see you, you salty yellow ball of light. Come in. The words appeared as text in Carlyle's lenses, and the log of them makes it easy for me to reconstruct the scene. Come in, I said. In, in, in. The sensei tiptoed across the walkway and peered into the Spartan trophy hall. Hello? Why are you back? Mycroft said you'd be back, but you don't come back, totally out of pattern. Did you leave something behind? Mycroft said I'd be back. Carlyle crept along the empty hall, nervous as a new cat. They said to tell you they're downstairs. They didn't say why you'd be back. Did you forget something? You don't leave your things very often. September 2nd, 51 is the last I have. Carlyle's breath caught when he reached the central room where Mukta hung in her place of honor, looking so like the textbooks. Or perhaps it was the two people sprawled on the floor who made him gasp. Both wore time-scuffed bathrobes over bodysuits of transparent conducting film, tight as a second skin. Thin, molded helmets covered their scalps and ears, and a strip of plastic taut across the eyes kept the real world's light from interfering with the computers. The films over their limbs were parked by the round red spots of tactile feedback discs, positioned far apart on the less discerning surfaces of shoulders and fleshy thighs, but dense as strawberry seeds on the nerve-packed skin of hands and faces, where a millimeter's difference is perceptible. One of the two snored softly, but the other waved. "Hello?" Carlyle smiled. "Hello? You must be Member Eureka Weeksbooth?" "Bingo." Perhaps Carlyle could see Eureka's subtle wiggles as they texted, or perhaps he thought he could. "And that's Member Sidney Coons?" Carlyle gestured to the sleeping one before remembering Eureka could not see. "You've read up on us." "I have to, if I'm going to be your sensei. My first appointment with you is next Thursday, I believe."
"Yep. 1500 Universal Time."
"Sit for a minute. I have questions."
Eureka flailed vaguely toward a couch to their left. "I will use they for Eureka, for there is nothing female about a creature to whom the body is no more than the mind's imperfect interface, and the sex organ one more convenient place to cluster sensors. Even if Eureka's robe falls so loose that this guest can see the spiral of peaking pubic hair, Carlyle would feel nothing but awkwardness.
"Why are you back?"
"I have your stat trail here. I know how often you go back to parishioners' places same day. It's practically never."
"My stat trail?"
Carlyle scratched his head, his blonde hair shining glossy in the light despite its neglectful overgrowth.
"Past car usage. Everyone has patterns.
I don't just have the system send cars when you call, I have to teach it to anticipate who'll likely call cars when, so it can pre-route them sensibly."
"Why did you come back here same day?"
"Way out of pattern. So exciting. I see radical pattern breaks sometimes, but I never get to ask directly why."
I saw Carlyle's flinch over the cameras, his first test keeping the secret. "Are you looking at my tracker data?"
"Part of it.
I only receive tracker data related to when you'll want a car. My system doesn't look at your image or audio feeds, just where you are, who's called you, work people, home people, things to tell the system where you're likely to want to go next. You never return to people's houses same day like this.
So why did you?"
"I wanted to talk to Thisbe again, or to that servicer named Mycroft, who apparently comes here a lot."
Carlyle's voice had that slight shrill edge of someone who fears he might be less than plausible.
"Yours is a very important bash, and this is a very special situation. When you all have the same sensei, and something happens to them, you all need to mourn at once, but you've just lost the one person who could help you do it. I need to help you get comfortable with me as quickly as I can, and sometimes that'll mean repeat sessions."
"Yeah. It's a problem all having the same sensei. Are you sitting yet?"
Carlyle had not sat, and paled now, catching himself staring at Eureka, at her mouth, the pale edge of the taste pad that filled it like a gag just visible between slack, silenced lips.
"Sorry."
He settled on the sofa.
"A bash all sharing a sensei is tough in this one situation, but it's still absolutely what I recommend. We can do so much more when we have the whole bash in context. You're really wise to ask for it. It speaks well of how carefully you're being custodians of yourselves as well as of the system."
Eureka twitched. But there was no way to guess whether it was a response to Carlyle or the lunch hour of some distant capital.
"It's just easier on Occam, not vetting multiple people through security stuff. But I don't know why you're the new pick. We asked for a humanist, and I specifically asked for a sensei who'd done Cartesian set-sets before."
"There were a lot of factors in picking someone for your bash. You all have special needs. I know I have a lot to learn, but I'm excited to get started.
I also said, no cousins. That shouldn't have been hard. No Brillists and no cousins.
Carlyle fiddled with his flowing gray-green cousin's wrap, uncomfortable watching a face that could not watch back. Just because set-set training is illegal in my hive doesn't mean I'm personally uncomfortable working with you.
But are you against set-set training in general? Personally, I mean. I have a right to know. It's not a religious question. It's a political question. You don't get to plead Sensei's neutrality.
Fair question, Carlyle answered cheerfully. But I don't have a firm opinion.
Don't dodge. Leslie and Occam have a right to know, too. First kid they have will be sent off for training, same as I was. They have a right to know if their sensei is thinking child abuse every time it comes up. And I have a right to ask for a sensei who doesn't think I'm a horrible human experiment.
At this point, I received a message from Eureka's brother, Cato Weeksbooth, asking me to get the sensei out of the living room. Carlyle smiled the slow, patient smile of one struggling to swallow something difficult with grace. Let me clarify. I have an opinion, but my opinion isn't firm. I'm fully aware that I don't really know anything about what it's like being a set-set. I have a gut reaction that to me it sounds horrific, growing up all wired to a computer, never playing with other kids or seeing the real sun. But I also know there's a lot of propaganda surrounding set-sets, and I don't even know if those clichés are true. I want to have my mind made up by getting to know you. I've met other kinds of set-sets briefly, a flash set-set, an abacus set-set, and they both said they were very happy. And I respect their opinions more than mine, since I know I don't know anything.
That's acceptably unbigoted. Either that, or you're being cagey, because you don't want to be fired.
The cousin's face was hard to read at that moment. Sad, perhaps. I could get another assignment, but I was proud to be trusted with one this important, so I would appreciate if you gave me a chance.
Do you really think you can work with me fairly?
I think I can if you help me. You can clear a lot of the propaganda.
Like what?
Did you really grow up in a computer, isolated from your Ba siblings, or is that propaganda?
I wasn't in isolation. I always knew Cato and Cardi and Occam and Thisbe and the twins. We texted all the time when we were growing up. It's not like we couldn't be real Ba-sibs just because my meat was in Seoul.
A shade of melancholy protest darkened Carlyle's face. I can guess the sorts of deprivations that trickled through his mind. No horseplay by the beach in this text-only childhood. No irresponsible late nights making fortresses of bunk beds. No hugs, changing month by month as Ba-sibs grow at different paces. Perhaps he thought of his cousin-run Foster Bash, swarming with colors, games, too effervescent for even the pain of lost parents to linger. Hers must have seemed a nightmare. As for Eureka's thoughts during the long pause, I can no more guess than I can imagine the set-set's all-sensory dreams or take over their all-important task. May I ask another?
Less politeness, more asking.
Carlyle smiled. I presume it's also propaganda that you never saw the sun.
True, actually. Well, training is totally different for different kinds of set-sets, but for a Cartesian, it's true. I first saw it when I was 17. It was smaller than I thought, and glarier. But now I can go watch a sunset any time. I just don't want to. It's boring. So slow. Monosensory. And before you fuss, I may have grown up never seeing a sunset. But you've never seen a six-dimensional Homo scedastic crest up from the day to sea. And you never will, because you're wasting those nerves on telling you your knee itches.
Carlyle ran his fingertip across his knee. Can you tell me what it's like?
You were watching my car, you said. Are you watching another one now?
Now? Right now I'm reviewing every car that flew in the last 10 hours, played back at 20 times speed, and I can keep them all straight. Speed, destination, age of vehicle. I can even tell which ones need the climate control retuned.
I've heard it looks like schooling fish?
Carlyle asked. That's your abacus set talking. Totally different training, sight-focused instead of all sense. Optimized to do mass calculations fast, not over extended time. I can keep it up for hours and hours. 5 days straight if I take anti-sleeps. And I use everything. Right now, I'm tracking 9 variables with sight, 10 with hearing, 5 really complicated ones with taste and smell, 9 with tactile, 6 with temperature, and 18 with nerves your body would use for pain, but mine are totally re-registered. Not unpleasant at all. So none of that crap about torture. It isn't torture. It's a sense. I just cultivated it differently. Same as when kids learn music early or languages. It's all different ways of cultivating brain growth.
Carlyle winced at cultivating, probably remembering the infamous Ongaro anti-set poster. Clippers snipping the last rebellious shoot from a tightly trimmed rosebush superimposed over a brain.
So what does it look like to you? Not fish? Not fish. It doesn't look like anything. Trying to say what it looks like with just sight is like explaining how pumpernickel tastes to someone who can only taste sour. You don't have the right senses. See, here you are, salty little yellow ball of light. But if I zoom select, there. Now you're a salty polygon with gradients. Oh, you're prickly on one end. No, 2 ends. But you have 5 ends, so that's not very prickly.
At this point, I received a second, more frantic and incoherent message from Cato Weeks Booth, simultaneously commanding and begging me to get the scary sensei out of the living room. I started up the stairs. Carlyle tugged free a lock of hair caught in his collar.
Are set-sets the only way to run the cars? I don't need this nurturist crap in my own home, cousin. I'm not a bird with its wings clipped. You're a bird stuck in its shell.
I hope, good reader, that the name of nurturist has faded by your age, that the zealots are quiet, and that the wound sliced by the violence is finally healed. For me, it has been 2 centuries since the Set-Set riots rocked our young alliance, so the wound is scabbed over. But reminders like Eureka still pick it raw.
Please, Carlyle answered, I'm not a nurturist. And I didn't mean the question adversarially. Honestly, I just genuinely want to know. It's such an adversarial topic, I can't ask anything without it being a question someone asked in anger sometime.
Fair. It's not the only way to run the system. It launched in 2170, but Cartesian set-sets weren't developed for another 40 years. Before we took over, they had almost 100 car crashes every year instead of 9, and the speeds were lower then, too. They couldn't fly safely over 900 kilometers per hour. Now we fly them over 1,000.
He nodded. You must be very proud, protecting so many people.
I'll be proud if I get it up to 1,100. Let everyone on Earth spend 90 less hours stuck in a car each year. That would be an achievement.
Carlyle smiled. That sentiment, at least, transcended the barrier of plastic and sensory rift.
So, why are you really back?
We are fortunate Eureka could not see the shock on Carlyle's face.
I told you.
You were lying. You say situations like this take multiple visits like it's a normal thing, but it's not normal. Your return probability wouldn't be under 1% if it was normal.
He floundered.
It's not normal. It's a very unusual situation.
Is it Thisbe? Love at first sight?
What?
I wouldn't blame you. Thisbe's great.
A facial expression might have helped Carlyle tell whether Eureka was joking, but a Homo sapiens, whose world since birth has been raw data swimming in the void, does not learn facial expressions like a normal child. Carlyle leapt to his feet.
Absolutely not. Thisbe's my parishioner.
You're one of those senseirs.
If you mean a senseir who takes my oath seriously, yes, I am. Carlyle on his feet, his cousin's rap swishing like storm, is what greeted me as I rounded the landing and reached the living room. The sight of me forced instant calm upon the senseir, but for the set-set, who sees only cars, I wasn't present in the room until I spoke. Sorry to interrupt, Member Eureka, but you're being a little cruel. I hadn't intended the words to have a double meaning, but they did in some sense apply to how Eureka was treating Carlyle, as well as how they were taunting Cato.
If my sib's such a big baby, they can't cross a room to use the bathroom with a stranger in the house. They deserve some toughening up.
Sib? Carlyle repeated, frowning his confusion. I smiled, apology. It is in no way your fault, Cousin Foster. Cato Weeksbooth is in that room, I pointed, and has been sending Eureka messages for several minutes. Cato desperately wants to cross through here to get to the bathroom, but they're phobically afraid of senseirs. Carlyle followed my gesture, and may have been quick enough to glimpse a sliver of black hair and white cloth through the cracked door before it slammed. Sorry, Carlyle called. I had no idea. I shook my head. It's not your fault. There's no way you could have known. I moved close enough to Cato's door for my gentle voice to reach him. I'm taking the senseir downstairs now, Dr. Weeksbooth. No need to worry. I'll make sure they leave by downstairs, and I'll let you know when they're gone. I will not repeat the sob-strained mix of thanks and curses which Cato muttered back. No, they were not even curses. Just those words that sound like curses which children use who aren't quite brave enough to say a real forbidden word. Better not to meet him here, good reader. Cato Weeksbooth is a beautiful, if fragile, creature, and I will have you meet him when he is a little more himself. Today, you meet Eureka. I turned to Carlyle and gestured to the stairs. Shall we go down? Carlyle was frowning hard at Eureka, his pale forehead wrinkled by a consternated mix of guilt and blame. Why didn't you say something? I would have gotten out of the way.
I don't help Cato be neurotic. It isn't good for them.
Carlyle opened his mouth to object, but caught himself. He smiled. Not a forced smile, but the kind where we smile for ourselves, to force away a darker feeling. I'm the intruder here, so it's your business. I look forward to getting to know you all better with time, unless you still want to request a different non-cousin senseir. Eureka twitched.
Is your opinion firmer now?
My opinion about set-sets? I can't make up my mind from just talking to you for 2 minutes.
Most people make up their minds talking to me for no minutes. I guess you aren't horrible. If Occam approves it, you can stay.
High praise. Thank you. Carlyle waited, but a set-set does not smirk. Shall we? I invited, returning to the stairs. Yes, thank you. Carlyle turned toward Cato's door. I'm leaving now, Doctor. I'm sorry. The senseir made it almost to the stairwell before text froze him in place.
You never said why you really came back.
A third time, the same question. Bosch security may be Occam's domain, but Eureka is a watchdog too. The keener because they know how to make interrogation feel like playful nosiness. My breath caught. It wasn't just the danger in the question. It was the sight of Carlyle's face, which relaxed into a smooth, angelic tranquility. beautiful and captivating like a piece of art, the statue smoothness of his cheeks, the childlike delicacy of his brows, the golden glimmer at the edges of his hanging hair. In that moment, he might have been his mother.
"Sensei business," he answered in a light, sweet voice. "I don't think I could describe it if I tried.
You don't have the right background or terminology. After all, I've cultivated my mind for something, too." It is hard for me to express what extraordinary praise Eureka's reply carried.
Voker.
Why do we shorten the words most precious to us? Bapa from Bosh parent, Ba-sib from Bosh sibling. In old days, mom from mother, prince from princeps, pope from papa, and here the hasty Voker, never the archaic vocateur. In 2266, when the work week finally shortened to 20 hours and crowds deserted those few professions which required more, the first anonymous, Aurel Gallet, rushed to defend vocation with a tract which is still mandatory reading for 3 hive entry programs. "Why is a calling passive?" he asked. "Why is one called helplessly to one's vocation when surely it is an active thing? I find my calling, take it, seize that delight, that path before me, make it mine. I call it like a summoned magic. It does not call me." His new word, vocateur, one who calls, was born to remind us that a person with a strong vocation is not a victim driven helplessly to toil, but a lucky soul whose work is also pleasure, and to whom 30, 40, 50 hours are welcome ones. Surely the inconvenience of pronouncing one more syllable is a small price to commemorate a term so powerful that here it cuts across the barrier to thrill the hearts of both cousin and Setset. Carlyle smiled a true, warm smile at the compliment. "You too." I led him down to Thisbe's empty room. There was a special feeling of release as I closed the door behind us, like shutting out the swelter of a fearsome August. I could see from Carlyle's easing shoulders that he felt it too. "How did you know I'd come back?" he asked. "You're a sane person, Member Foster. After what you saw, how could you not come back?" He laughed, but only for a moment. "It was real, right? I didn't imagine it." "It was real," I confirmed, and I watched his face relax as at the touch of dew. "I've been telling myself it was real, thinking about nothing else. I mean, I didn't doubt my memory. I remember clearly, but the more I thought about it, the more it felt like it couldn't be real." It took me months to stop needing to be reassured. "Sit, please, Member Foster." My gesture had offered Thisbe's velvet-covered water couch, which took up half of one wall, but Carlyle chose instead my little folding stool, on which one could perch with energy, ready to spring. "No need to be so formal," he answered. "Just Carlyle is fine." "Carlyle," I repeated. "I will apologize in advance for slipping. Formality is rather a habit for me." "No problem," he smiled. "And you prefer Mycroft?"
"Yes, if you please."
I knelt and took up my scrub and vacuum. "It was real. You'll probably need reassurance often. You shouldn't call me, my tracker's monitored, but I assume you have Thisbe's tracker number already. Thisbe should be willing to answer if you need to hear somebody say it's real." He nodded. "Do you have... I was hoping to see proof again. The little soldiers or something."
"Of course. I brought this for you."
I rose and offered him a tiny paper book, too small to cover the surface of his pinky nail, even when opened. No matter how keenly our lenses zoom in on that book, they only show more detail. The letters finer than pinpricks. The surface of the paper, thumb-smeared corners and food-stained favorite parts. It is not beyond science to make such an object, but it is beyond technology Thisbe and I might plausibly access. Carlyle took some moments to explore the tiny proof. May I? Is it too much to ask to keep this? To remind myself? Nothing leaves here. No physical evidence. Not yet. Not until Bridger decides they're ready. I understand. He stroked the tiny spine. It's a big thing. Yes. He paused. It's the biggest thing, really. The biggest thing. I did not have an answer which would not have strained his vows. Give yourself a scratch with the pages, I suggested. On your thumbnail. They're so thin that static cling sticks them together into clumps, but if you can separate a good clump, you can give yourself a very visible scratch that'll last a long time as the nail grows out. It's not proof, but it's how I used to leave myself a reminder that it was real. It'll help. He looked from me to the tiny relic on his palm. Yes. Yes, good idea, thank you. That's just the thing. I smiled as I watched him struggle to get just the right sized clump, laughing a little inside. This was also easy for Carlyle, with my 10 years' experience at his service. I was glad I could make it gentler for someone. When my world had been force rewritten in an instant, I had faced only tiny, hostile bayonets and toddler babble. Carlyle finished and sat back, smiling at his precious proof. What are you doing? He asked, nodding at my chemical scrub. Destroying evidence. There was a break-in upstairs. The police must not find signs of Bridger. I smiled to make it feel less criminal. Thisbe's out on a date and Bridger's gone to bed, but I will answer whatever questions I can for you. If you're like me, you'll have 100 new questions a day for the next month. His smile grew sheepish. I do have a lot of questions. What are the limits of this power? What exactly can Bridger do? The big one first. I have no idea what limits, if any, Bridger's power has. I can only describe what I've seen them do. They can animate representations. Any representation real enough to feel real to them, a mud pie, a doll, a drawing. That may be all they can do. Or there may be 1,000 other things, but Bridger is a timid kid and understands play and feels comfortable with toys, so that's the only sort of thing they've done so far. He nodded. When they make things real, do they become what Bridger imagines or what the maker of the thing imagines? You know how sometimes a kid might play with a doll that's supposed to be some movie character, but the kid doesn't know the character and invents a different one. I nodded. It seems to become something of a mixture. Bridger found a toy hot air balloon once and burned himself on the fire inside. They knew what the balloon was, but not how it worked. But when they miracled it, it had fire anyway. And the soldiers' guns and things have working, moving parts which Bridger couldn't name or recognize. The soldiers speak modern English like a child would expect, but they don't have modern attitudes. They have attitudes of hundreds of years ago when those ancient soldier toys were made. They use he and she and swear by religious things in public and remember a darker age. Do they? Carlyle frowned. This is a hard question to phrase, but do they remember real things, real lives? A toy doll of a fairy tale prince is pretend, but toy soldiers are representations of real soldiers who really lived. Has Bridger created pretend soldiers or recreated real people who really lived and died? If they were real, there's no way to look them up. They don't have real historical people's names. They have the childish names Bridger gave them. Pointer, Croucher, Looker. But Bridger did miracle a real person once. Wide eyes. They did? A photograph from an old book. A friendly-looking person they wanted to play with. Emma Platz was their name. Bridger didn't make that one up. With flat pictures, it works as if you were talking to each other through a screen. The person on the other side can see and hear you, but you can't reach them.
Carlyle leaned toward me with such energy he almost toppled the little stool. Is there a whole world in the image? Can other people show up? Does time pass?
I frowned. We've only tried it the once. There's a limit to how much you can experiment with creating life before it becomes too cruel, for Bridger as well as for the subject. You know how kids fall apart when a pet dies and it was their fault. It was much worse with Emma.
What went wrong?
I felt myself wince at the memory.
Emma couldn't stay in the portrait chair forever. Not without food and drink and having to go to the bathroom. They went out to the edge of the photo and never came back. We don't know why. Possibly they ceased to exist when they left the frame, but from their end they said they could see all the other rooms and places in the house just fine. We've considered animating another photograph, but it's too hard on Bridger. When they're grown and ready, then we can try more.
He nodded.
What did Emma remember? Was it their real life or an imaginary one? I couldn't confirm.
They remembered a whole lifetime up to death, but not a very traceable life. It was a very early photograph from when unfamous people left few records, women more so. I found documents pointing to a couple different people who could have been our Emma Plotz, but there wasn't much to trace.
Do you still have the photograph?
Of course, but the miracle's worn off. The daylight in the room isn't changing anymore.
It wears off?
Yes, I caught myself. Carlyle, for inanimate objects, it's permanent. But it seems life is a special kind of miracle that doesn't last so long. Bridger has to re-miracle the soldiers every month or so, and Boo.
Life is a special kind of miracle, he repeated, half-whispered like a prayer.
I nodded. That's why Bridger can't just raise the dead.
Carlyle froze.
Right, right.
He paused.
You and I cannot read minds, reader. But we both know the torrent of possibilities which were multiplying in Carlyle from that thought.
Did Emma Plotz...
No, it wouldn't help.
Did Emma Plotz what?
I caught a tremor in his lips. Did Emma Plotz remember the afterlife? I felt my heart thrill at the question, too, a sensei's question.
No, but Pointer may tomorrow, when Bridger brings them back.
Pale skin went paler.
You've decided, then? To bring them back?
Not yet, but Bridger will feel sad and guilty every day forever if they don't do it.
Could you resist day in, day out, if you could resurrect a friend?
No. No, I couldn't. No one could. I did not correct him. I waited for more questions, but four breaths passed and Carlyle was still mulling on the afterlife, fidgeting with his hair and watching me hazily as I crawled across the floor. I watched him in return. The curve of his little chin, the fierce blue of his eyes, almost unnatural. Many would say it is unnatural, since his mother's perfection had been handcrafted trait by trait from the finest chromosomes French ancestry offered. But Aristotle, the philosopher, reminds us that man is an animal, a part of nature just as much as fruit and vine. So Danae's two blue eyes, two practiced gestures, even her lotus blossom tower of glass and steel, are all as natural as a peacock's plumes. Or beaver dams.
Why were you given this assignment? I asked at last.
Carlyle was still staring more through me than at me.
That is the question.
Nothing could have endeared the cousin to me more. He thought I meant it metaphysically, that I meant to ask what fate, what hand, what meddling spirit or inexorable clockmaker had placed him in Bridger's path. That's all he thought of. Even after Eureka's questioning, it didn't occur to him that I was suspicious of his assignment,
that I smelled a rat behind this green young cousin who had been granted access to this most private humanist Bosch. If there was a motive, some enemy of the humanists or of Ando and Danae moving in the dark, this sweet, sincere, true vocateur sensei didn't know. When you started to doubt it was real, I began softly, was it because you thought it was impossible? Or was it because it's something you've always wanted to be true so badly that now that it is true, you're worried you just deceived yourself into believing? Something in the question made him hide behind his hair. I've never wished to bring toys to life. Miracle. That is what you're thinking. I know it is. You said you weren't afraid of the word miracle. You know I can't discuss too deeply. You can. This isn't a session, member, Carlyle. You're not my sensei. I have a court-appointed sensei. If this isn't a session, it's borderline illegal. I rose. Some things should not be said while on one's knees. It's a law we have to break. I met his gaze and held it. We have to. In the name of science, reason, all humanity. Something is happening with Bridger, something real, magical, metaphysical. We have to discuss it, test it. We have to figure out what to do. It could be the most important thing that's ever happened. Or things like this could have happened 100,000 times throughout history, but there's some deeper reason history hid them all. This isn't a question of us risking disrupting world peace by spreading some cult belief. This is a question of uncovering the deep truth about the provable reality humanity lives in, and someday sharing that. I want to say that Carlyle paused to steel himself, but his movements were all the signatures of weakness, huddling, hugging himself within the encircling looseness of his cousin's wrap, like a child amid the covers. But I think, in his gentle way, that was his steel. I could say many cults have thought the same. But you're right. The potential is too great. The immediate human applications, if we can understand this power. We can't investigate it fully without talking about the theological end as well. He took a deep breath. And, on that note, I've been thinking, is it really right to wait and not show Bridger to anyone until they're an adult? What if something happens in the meantime? What if Bridger falls and breaks their neck? All that potential gone. And even without that, there's all the good this power could do that isn't being done in the meantime. Not raising the dead, necessarily. That has a lot of other implications we have to look at. But smaller things. Bridger could cure stereococcus. We have. What? I had Bridger make a cure 18 months ago. And sent it anonymously to Peli Chemical. Testing is underway. You did? Remember 3 years ago when they found a treatment for Waldvogel's vein? That was Bridger too. He swallowed. But Bridger can do more than just cure one disease. That healing potion can make wounds vanish instantly. And if something like that turned up anonymously on a lab's doorstep, all the king's horses and all the king's men wouldn't rest until they'd traced it. We've tried to test it, but the potion transformed the microscope itself. It's beyond current science, or at least beyond equipment we can get at without leaving a paper trail. Hopefully science will explain it someday, even reproduce it, but they won't learn to really understand it without access to the source. For that, Bridger needs to be ready to face becoming the center of all the hope and envy of the world. And before that can happen, they need to learn to talk to strangers. Carlyle nodded, but there was still an edge of huddle in his poise. But every day, I stood my ground, moral calculus like that will drive you crazy. The people who die today or tomorrow because they don't have Bridger's potions aren't on your conscience any more than the people who died yesterday or 1,000 years ago. We're doing what we can with Bridger. We're on the edge now of moving from baby steps to real steps. You're the first real step,
If you do well, the second may come soon. That's all anyone could ask. He smiled. Yes, you're right. And I can do it well. I know I can. The growl of his angry stomach cut him off. I laughed aloud. You forgot to feed yourself today, didn't you? I guess I did. There's a lunchbox on the table, I offered. Good and fresh. Eat. Thank you. He took it, and had started on the dainty knot before he realized. Wait, this... I can't take food from a servicer. You earned this. I'm supposed to feed you. I almost snickered. Bridger can make filet mignon out of cardboard. I'm not going to go hungry. He returned my smile. Thank you. Of course. I mumbled it, distracted by remembering whose delicate fingers prepared that plump little lunch that Fate and I had placed in the Gagjean's hands. I mean, you're welcome. It's the least I can offer after I tackled you before. Thank you for not reporting me. Carlyle's smile grew richer. You've offered a lot more than that. You did this very well, very gently. You answered a lot and pushed me when I needed to be pushed. You're right that we have to talk about this, about what we think it means, that we have to use words like miracle, metaphysics, fate, as well as magic and phenomenon. But you haven't pushed me to actually do it yet. I knelt once more to my work. It's easy to tell you're the one who's exhausted. True enough, he chuckled at himself. Were you a sensei? This was an unexpected stroke. Carlyle has absorbed a little of that art of cutting to the quick which the current conclave teaches, but in him it is usually stifled by natural gentleness. I realize, reader, that I should apologize for my confusing language, since if my he and she mean anything, then certainly this sweet and gentle cousin in her flowing wrap should be she. In this case, alas, I am commanded by an outside power to give Carlyle the masculine, to remind you that this long-lost scion is a prince, not princess, a fact which matters in the eyes of some and of the law. But I shall do my best to remind you often that a cousin's maternal heart beats beneath Carlyle's broad chest, and I promise, reader, to be consistent in making other cousins she. No, I was never a sensei or anything, I answered. I committed my crimes too young. Pity touched his kind, too keen blue eyes, willing to forgive any convict, however great our unknown crimes. Would you have been one? You have that feel when you talk. I don't know. I never thought that far ahead. But if I were a sensei, and if this were a session, I think I would say now that you've had enough new revelations for one day, and that you should take that lunchbox home to rest and digest. All the universe and Bridger will still be here tomorrow, as will I. This may be the highest compliment Carlyle can pay. You would have made a good one. Here ends the first day of this history. Chapter the Sixth. Rome was not built in a day. But it was built in a year, as the new saying goes. Roma Nova, a sparkling sea of marble and bright bronze, built up from nothing in 300 days to be the capital of our new world of hives. In 2198, Emperor Agrippa Mason was tasked to choose a plan for the Alliance capital. Among the endless submissions of grand grids and lavish spectacle cities, an unofficial entry surfaced. Number 40 and a half, containing nothing but a cheap tourist's poster of ancient Rome, which had been slipped into the mix by a bold young secretary named Mycroft Ragbinder, or Frustanixor, to give a mason's name its rightful Latin. The smart aleck even labeled the ancient buildings with suggested modern counterparts. the Alliance Senate in the Senate House, the Supreme Polylaw Court in the Basilica Julia, the Sensei's Conclave in the House of the Vestal Virgins. Agrippa Mason saw genius in the plan, a message to the world that, despite how tattered